It's not all in your head.
We think of pain, of chronic pain, as a symptom of something else. But what it really is a disease in its own right. It becomes a disease of the nervous system itself.
That's Judy Foreman. We spend the hour with her talking about America's biggest health problem, chronic pain. Her book is A Nation in Pain. Million Americans suffer from chronic pain. For 10 to 30% of them, the pain is severe. Yet our medical system is failing to deal adequately with the problem. Doctors get shockingly little education for pain management, and attitudes towards pain medication often falls more heavily on fears of giving patients too much instead of enough to handle the pain. Like my guest this hour, health journalist Judy Foreman, many patients find that doctors throw up their hands in the face of chronic pain, often putting the cause down as psychological in origin. But they have it the wrong way round. Scientists are finding that chronic pain actually changes the brain and can result in the loss of gray matter equal to 20 years of aging. It can cause depression and affect thinking. So while it's not all in your head, it does affect your head. As Foreman struggled to find treatments that would work to relieve her pain, her journalistic instincts drove her to find out what chronic pain is, why our society seems unable to confront it, and what we should be doing better. The result is her fascinating book, A Nation in Pain. Its central thesis is that chronic pain is a disease in its own right and deserves to be treated as a serious health problem it is. Judy Foreman is an award-winning medical journalist. She was a staff writer at the Boston Globe for 23 years, where she wrote the weekly Health Sense column, and has been a medical specialist and science writer since 1985. She was the host of a weekly call-in webcast on health issues for healthtalk.com. A Nation in Pain is her first book. I spoke with Judy Foreman earlier this month. Judy Foreman, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
This book, A Nation in Pain, I think I could say it's really comprehensive. It covers the science, it covers the social issues, it covers medical issues, the pharmaceutical industry. It's really a terrific book. And you also have a personal story that kind of underlies how you came into it. I wonder if you could start with that.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that is what got me into writing the book. I'm a science writer by trade, and so there's a certain curiosity there. And when I got this horrific neck pain, I mean, not right in the middle of the horrible pain, but once it eased a bit, I thought, I really should write about this. There's a whole lot here. So what happened to me was, things were going well in my life, so I don't think there was any psychological or kind of life event trigger, but my neck just started about 5 years ago going crazy. It would hurt, like if I was sitting in a chair and leaning down to pick up a pencil off the floor, or turning my head just like a millimeter to the side, or practically any motion would be horrendously painful. I would go from feeling no pain to like a 10 on the 10-point scale, and it was just excruciating, and I had never felt anything like that in my life. And frankly, to be honest, if I hadn't felt that kind of pain myself, I would not have believed that it existed. I mean, I'm a mother. I went through childbirth, and that was nothing. Really nothing compared to this kind of pain. because in childbirth, you know, you're in labor, and it definitely hurts. I mean, I'm not minimizing that. But the cause is clear. You are believed when you say you're in pain. There are things doctors can do about it. They can give you an epidural. And at the end of it all, you if you're lucky, you get a baby. And none of those things are true with chronic pain. It hurts even more. It doesn't stop. And no one, many times people can't figure out what's wrong. And no one really believes you except, you know, the doctors who are really pain specialists. So it's a totally different animal.
And that's some of the experience you had, an experience that you share with 100 million adults. I mean, that is, as you say, 40% of adult Americans. That's unbelievable.
I know. Yes, it is. People don't realize what a widespread problem it is. Now, these 100 million, not all of them have pain, that chronic pain that is as excruciating as I had it, but an estimated 10 to 30% do. And their lives, like mine, can be completely done in by it. I mean, it's really, it takes over your life. It really takes over your life.
And it's really kind of a conundrum in many ways. I mean, as you said, and when you tell your story in your book, A Nation in Pain, you know, you weren't really believed to begin with. A lot of people think it's all in the mind.
Yeah, and that is, you know, that is literally like adding insult to injury. You know, the basic problem is that there's no real easy test for pain. I mean, there's no blood test. There's not really good x-rays or MRIs. I mean, in my case, I did finally, my doctor ordered an MRI, and it did show, you know, various messed up things in my neck, which I can tell you about. But many people are in pain, and their x-rays or their MRIs look fine. So you can't really go by that. And a lot of things like with fibromyalgia or irritable bowel syndrome, I mean, the cause is never really totally clear. I should say that, you know, increasingly there are these fancy tests called F as in functional MRIs, so functional MRIs, and they do show, you know, what happens in the brain when you are in severe chronic pain. But those are expensive tests, and, you know, with pain being the main reason people go to doctors, you know, most doctors can't afford to have these machines in their office. So they're dependent on listening to the patient, and all too often they don't.
And you say that while pain is not, you know, all in the mind, it is a disease of the nervous system. There's a fascinating discussion in your book about how pain actually happens. And it is complicated, so I'm not sure we can boil it down to, you know, some easy phrases. But make a stab at explaining to our listeners how pain happens.
Okay, and I think the distinction that you're creeping up on is the difference between acute pain and chronic pain. First of all, let me give you the overall definition of pain, which is, and I'm quoting from the International Association for the Study of Pain, which is an academic group of like 9,000 neuroscientists, pain is an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience associated with actual or potential tissue damage or described in terms of such damage. That's a nice kind of comprehensive definition because it gets at the emotional part, which is an intrinsic part of pain, and the fact that people describe the pain in terms of tissue damage even when you can't actually find that tissue damage. So what happens a lot of the time is that acute pain, like sort of, you might even call it normal, obvious pain, where there's a clear-cut injury, that can be transformed into chronic pain. The nervous system essentially gets revved up like a runaway freight train or something. It gets better and better and better at transmitting the sensory signals for pain. It's like we use our nervous system and our brains for learning French or learning to play the piano. Essentially, the same thing is happening with pain. And it's like the body is practicing sending pain signals. And inevitably, it gets better and better and better at doing it until the original trigger often can't be found and the system gets a life of its own. And that's what happens with chronic pain. They actually call it the chronicization of pain, the making chronic of what started out as acute pain.
You know, something my listeners probably don't know about me, but I was a massage therapist, among my other things that I did for many years. And as a massage therapist, we talked about something called the pain cycle, where you feel some pain, you tense up, there's lessening blood flow, you feel pain as a result of that, and then you tense up even more. And, you know, I know in my experience that I felt that when I was able to relieve pain, and this includes chronic pain, not just acute, it involved in some way interrupting that pain cycle. Is that something that is involved in some of this? And it's not just releasing tension, but it really felt like a neurological thing that I was trying to interrupt.
Oh, you absolutely were. It is a neurological thing. And it's also, there can be a pain cycle, there is a pain cycle involving psychological things too. And again, I just want to make very clear, I am not saying that the person's pain is all in their head or they're making it up. But one of the things that happens to many people who get chronic pain, even doctors when they get chronic pain, they, you know, the pain is so, can be so overwhelming and disruptive. I mean, you can't do your life. You can't, some people can't work. I mean, I had a hard time getting from sitting on the bed to lying down. You become a grouch just because it's so hard to be nice when you're in that kind of pain. And, you know, obviously, a lot of people become depressed because of the pain. And so it's important to try to interrupt that pain cycle as well as the one that you were able to interrupt by massage, which is why some of the things like meditation, and we can go into that more, and massage, and things that can have a psychological benefit as well as a straightforward neurological benefit, anything you can do to interrupt the pain cycle can really help. And I'd love to tell you more about that.
Yeah, and I'd like to talk more about that a little bit later on as we, after we go through some more on the science of pain. You say some folks are more susceptible to chronic pain. Why is that? What's involved?
Oh, well, that's a great question, and I'm glad you brought it up because most people don't know that genes, you know, the DNA that we all get from our parents, play a big role in who is likely to have chronic pain and how bad it's likely to be. Again, this sort of goes back to people thinking and being told that the pain is all in their head. But a lot of the research on the genes, there's about, I'd say, 15 genes that are of top interest to pain geneticists. They have a huge influence on how susceptible we are to chronic pain. And by the way, this is not just something that's found in people. They have showed this, especially up at McGill University in Canada. A lot of studies with mice and rats find a huge heritable component, a very high chance that if, say, if one twin or one litter mate has a lot of chronic pain, the animal or human that is genetically identical will also be very likely to have a lot of pain. Not 100%, but way more than the odds would have it otherwise. Now, so that again helps make the point that pain is really real. And I just want to say, in my book, there's two just really gripping examples of this genetic thing. I talked to one woman on the West Coast who inherited a gene. I won't bother your listeners with the name of it, but it means that her pain nerves are sort of stuck in the firing position all the time. She is in pain 24/7, and so are other people in her family because it is passed down from one person to another. There's also an example in the book of a young girl, a teenager in Georgia, who has a different mutation in the same gene, and she can never feel pain at all. So these are kind of extreme examples, but they really show how important the genes are in triggering or not triggering chronic pain.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Judy Foreman about chronic pain, how it's being mistreated, and how to treat it better. Her book is A Nation in Pain. And that second example just highlights that pain is actually something we need because people who can't feel pain get terribly injured.
That's true. We need acute pain. We need to know that we've hit our thumb with a hammer or stuck our hand in the fire by accident. That's acute pain. But we don't need chronic pain. That's the weird thing, is that acute pain is functional. It is adaptive. It helps us survive as a species because we learn to avoid whatever thing it was that caused the pain. With chronic pain, it's totally different. That is completely maladaptive. It didn't help me to survive or be a better person or any. It didn't help me in any way to be in this kind of chronic pain. And that's true for other people who have these chronic pain syndromes. It's maladaptive. And that's the weird and actually still fairly puzzling feature about it.
And you call it a disease of the neurological system. It's actually a disease, chronic pain.
Exactly. That, I mean, you've picked up on, thank you. You've really gotten the most important finding of this book, which is that pain, we think of pain, of chronic pain, as a symptom of something else. But what it really is a disease in its own right. It becomes a disease of the nervous system itself. And there's a wonderful TED Talk that I could suggest to your listeners. It's by Elliot Crane, K-R-A-N-E, from Stanford, and he shows how he illustrates that, you know, if you, for someone in chronic pain, if you just touch their arm with a feather, it feels to them as if you're touching it with a blowtorch, because their nervous system is so, essentially so hyperactive, that everything, every little minute touch feels like a blowtorch. And that is when pain has become its own disease.
You know, it's interesting. It sounds as if it may be akin to the mechanism that people who are hypersensitive and sensorily hypersensitive, for example, people who have autism or on the autism spectrum, I wonder if that's some of the same thing that's happening, people who just get overwhelmed, easily overwhelmed by sensory stimuli.
That's a great question. And, you know, I didn't explore that in my book, but it makes a ton of sense. The one kind of tangential thing I can say to that, women tend to have a lot more pain than men. And one of the theories, there's many theories for that, but one is that women are kind of programmed neurologically to be extra alert to their environment. Evolutionarily, you can suppose that that's to be alert to be able to take care of the young. But I think women's own bodies kind of pay a price for that because they are very alert to a lot of these signals. So yeah, you're right.
And actually, I wanted to ask you that about gender differences. You also say there's a role that that estrogen can play in that. Is that correct?
Yes. The basic finding, well, there's several, that women have a lot more of the chronic pain conditions like fibromyalgia, irritable bowel, migraines especially, and other things that can strike both sexes. They strike women more often and more severely. The weird thing is, in puberty, little boys and little girls have roughly the same amounts of pain. I'm speaking, again, chronic pain. You know, there's really no big difference. Once puberty hits, which suggests a hormonal influence, things really diverge. By and large, it looks as though testosterone, the hormone that's more prevalent in men, probably protects against pain. And estrogen, unfortunately, is all over the place. Sometimes it seems to protect against pain, and sometimes it seems to make it worse. And it also fluctuates monthly over the menstrual cycle. It fluctuates over the life cycle. Some women have more pain after menopause. Some have less. Some have more pain with hormone replacement therapy. Some have less. And there's even an interesting preliminary study that was done a few years ago in Italy with transgender people, and the people who went from male to female and therefore were taking estrogen began reporting more pain, and the people who went the other way from female to male and began taking testosterone reported less pain. So again, that's a clue that these hormones are really, really, really important. And also women respond differently to morphine and some of the basic pain formulations for medications, too, than men. To the degree, actually, that some researchers think that someday we will actually need pink pills for women, or should have pink pills for women and blue pills for men. The differences are that big.
Wow. You also say that the immune system has a role to play in pain. This was something completely new to me. Just tell us how that happens.
Sure. You know, it's not only new to you, it's new to most doctors, because doctors get very little education about pain in medical school, only about 9 hours on the average. So they don't really know. But immune cells definitely help in that process that I was talking about, the revving up of the nervous system. It turns out that these cells, they have kind of a funny name, microglial cells, glial, G-L-I-A-L. It's like Greek and Latin for glue. And until recently, like really in the last 10 years or so, people, neurologists and scientists used to think that these glial cells, that all they did was kind of be the scaffolding and the glue that would hold the nerve cells together in the nervous system. Now it turns out that they're actually very active. And when pain signals come in through sensory nerves, that also activates these little glial cells, which live in the nervous system and actually outnumber the nerve cells by a lot, that their chemistry gets turned on, and they secrete all these chemicals that bounce back to the nerve cells and kind of keep the whole thing going in a continuous feedback loop. So it's kind of a evil twins. These immune cells and the nerve cells work together to crank up the pain signals.
And you talk about something called the gate control theory.
Yes, that is from Ronald Melzack from McGill University, developed that many, many years ago. And the idea is basically that the pain signals go up from the periphery, like our fingers and toes and arms and legs, up through the spinal cord, through little structures called the dorsal horn. It's kind of like a relay station. And then from there up to the brain. And there's also signals that go down from the brain to the periphery. And the downward signals are sort of trying to control how open or closed the gate is. They're trying to inhibit the pain. And they are there, and they do help. If they weren't there, we'd all be feeling much more pain than we do. But they, you know, it's kind of like a balancing act. But when pain gets severe, the upwardly mobile signals can kind of swamp the downwardly mobile good guy signals that are trying to dampen down the pain.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Judy Foreman about her book, A Nation in Pain, Healing Our Biggest Health Problem. So is this part of how pain actually changes the brain? Although I think it has other effects as well. I mean, how does pain change the brain?
The how is less clear than the that. When the pain signals go up through the spinal cord to the brain, they actually fan out to a whole bunch of different areas of the brain that scientists have now mapped out pretty carefully. They go not only to the places that receive the sensory signals, but to the limbic system, where the brain is processed emotionally. And, you know, that means, by the way, that there's no way, if you're feeling intense pain, that you will not have an emotional reaction to it. They also go to the more cognitive processing centers of the brain. So basically, a lot of different areas of the brain get involved. And what scientists, actually from Northwestern University, were the first to show 10 years ago in 2004, they showed that for people in chronic pain, and they started out with people with chronic low back pain, there is a loss of the gray matter. That's the brain tissue looks either gray or white under the microscope, depending on which kind of tissue it is, that there's a loss of gray matter, like 5 to 10 or 11% of the person's gray matter gets lost with chronic pain, and that this loss of volume of brain tissue is basically equal to about 20 years of aging. So in a very real, concrete, literal way, chronic pain can and does change the brain. And this has been shown now not just for chronic back pain, but for, again, lots of different types of chronic pain.
It sounds almost as if you're describing a kind of mind-body ecosystem. I mean, this idea that it involves the emotions, you know, the limbic system in the brain, it involves all kinds of, you know, the immune system, the nervous system. It's very hard to tease out what's one and what's the other. Maybe one doesn't even have to. There's just this whole interaction between emotion and the body.
You are completely right. And I like your term, a mind-body ecosystem. I'm going to write that down. That's a much more vibrant term than the term that scientists use. Scientists use the term biopsychosocial, which is getting at the same thing, that a person's experience of pain, and of course of other things as well, but chronic pain in particular, you know, it involves the biology, it involves the psyche, and it involves social things too. I mean, if people are dissing you because of your pain, or even if they're over empathizing with you, they can make your pain worse or better. You know, some empathy really helps, too much doesn't help, as it turns out. But you're completely right that it is ultimately a mind body thing. In fact, I have a whole chapter that's deliberately called Mind Hyphen Body in Pain, because there is so much interaction both ways. And I just want to make a point, and we can do more on this if you want, but that there's a huge overlap between pain and depression. And it used to be thought that the depression came first, that people who were depressed were more likely to get chronic pain. And that is still true. That does happen. But by and large, it happens the other way around, that it's people who are in pain that they can't get rid of, that triggers the depression. And this has shown up on brain scans. They can really literally show on these fMRI brain scans that a person in a bad mood, a certain part of their brain lights up when they're in pain. And when they're in a good mood, that part doesn't light up, even though they're still in pain. So there is a huge, very delicate interaction.
And is that one reason why, in some cases, antidepressants can help pain?
That is absolutely one reason why that works. And also, it also means that if a person has chronic pain and depression, you have to treat both. By and large, the antidepressants work better against depression than against the pain, but they help and they can interrupt what you were talking about earlier, this pain cycle. You know, if you can make the depression a little bit less and help the person feel a little bit more in control of their life emotionally, that can knock the pain down a little. And then if you can knock the pain down through other ways, that can help the depression. So it definitely goes back and forth. But you do have to attack it from both sides.
It's interesting. You know, it makes me think that, well, massage, you know, something that gives good touch. It feels good. And in some way that may be, you know, it's teaching the body about good feeling, and that can counteract the bad feeling. Maybe that's one reason why, you know, just speculating, why massage so often works. I mean, I had the experience when I was early on in my career as a massage therapist, I was working in a physical therapy clinic, and they would always send me their patients who were in pain that they couldn't do anything about the pain. You know, they had been through every treatment. And then, you know, as a last resort, they'd send them to me. And often massage worked.
Well, it's a shame that that's a last resort. You know, it's crazy that massage and acupuncture and these other things that have been shown to help end up being a last resort, because those kinds of things, by and large, are benign. They usually do no harm. Although I can tell you, acupuncture is basically very safe. But when my neck pain was at its worst, I went to my physical therapist, and she just touched very lightly on the back of my neck, and it was excruciating. And the reason that happened, she's a fantastic physical therapist. The reason that happened is this thing we were talking about a little earlier on how the nervous system gets revved up so that the touch of a feather feels like a blowtorch. The technical name for that is allodynia, allodynia, and it means this hypersensitivity. So in that particular case, when my pain was at its worst, I couldn't have it massaged. I mean, her mere touch triggered it. Afterwards, when things calmed down a bit, then the massage was just incredibly useful. And massage, I should say, is one of the most popular treatments. I got a lot of data from the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine. Massage is one of the most popular treatments, particularly for lower back and neck pain that people go to. Americans use it a lot, and they should, in my opinion, use it even more.
Mm. But that's also a good caveat that you made. I think that is important to note.
And just by the way, the same thing happened to me with acupuncture, which I also love, and for which there's quite a bit of good data now on its effectiveness. When my acupuncturist, whom I also think is fantastic, put the needles in my neck, I had to rip them out. They, in the acute phase, they were actually making it worse. I've since been back many, many times with less acute pain, and it's wonderful. It really does help a lot.
That's Judy Foreman, journalist and author of A Nation in Pain, Healing Our Biggest Health Problem. We'll talk more after the break. Stick around.
Plus ou moins ce qu'on cherche, j'aime rire ou chanter, et je n'empêche pas les gens qui sont bien d'être joyeux. Pourtant c'est le ton sans bas, sans tristesse, c'est un vin qui ne donne pas l'ivresse, un vin qui ne donne pas l'ivresse. Donc ce n'est pas la samba que je veux.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're airing my interview with Judy Foreman. I spoke to her earlier this month about her terrific book, A Nation in Pain, Healing Our Biggest Health Problem. It's a comprehensive and fascinating exploration of what chronic pain is, what's wrong with how our nation treats it, and better ways to treat it, including a saner approach to pain medication and non-drug treatments like massage, acupuncture, exercise, and meditation. Let's talk a little bit about the attitudes towards pain. I think you've pointed out that, a lot of people lack empathy. They think you're kidding when you're in chronic pain. Physicians are not properly educated about pain. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there's a lot embedded in your question. The sheer basic bottom line fact is that doctors learn almost nothing about pain in medical school. There was a big study from Johns Hopkins a couple years ago. They surveyed, I think it was 117 medical schools, and the median number of hours of pain education that doctors got, and this is over 4 years in medical school, was 9. And that's pathetically little, given that chronic pain is the main reason that people go to doctors in the first place, and it's actually a bigger problem than cancer, diabetes, and heart disease all put together. So patients are going to doctors who are woefully unprepared to deal with them. In terms of doctors' attitudes, in doctors' defense, they get burned out, and they see a lot of pain. They don't really know what to do with it, and I have some survey data in my book that shows doctors feel like they're not prepared to deal with people in pain. And yes, they tend not to believe it until they've had it themselves, and that, to me, the almost the best part of my book, or subjectively from my point of view, was when I interviewed a lot of doctors who themselves, by accident, had become pain patients. And they were stunned to realize that they got dissed by other doctors. And then when they went to doctors for help, the doctors they went to didn't know what to do. In fact, there's a wonderful man who is head of, or just retired as head of, Stanford Medical School. And he was head of the Institute of Medicine committee that wrote this humongous report on pain a couple of years ago. And when he, after all this, he was semi-retired, and he the report was out, and he got pain, and he also got bounced from doctor to doctor, didn't get the right diagnosis, and says that, that his whole experience really made him mindful that even he, who probably knows more about pain than anybody in the country, realized that he had not tended to believe patients as much as he now does when they say they're in severe pain. So, I mean, it's such a subjective thing that if you have not had it yourself, you tend not to believe your patients. And that's, unfortunately, that's just wrong.
And this is also on intersecting with another huge collision course, and that is between the epidemic of the street use of opioids and the epidemic of pain that we have in this country. So doctors are actually reluctant to prescribe pain medication.
That's completely right. And if you hadn't gone there, I was going to go there myself. Yeah, we basically have two major problems, although they're not equal in size. There is definitely a fair amount of painkiller abuse, and there are some deaths from painkiller abuse. I think the latest figures from 2010 from the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, there are 16,651 opioid-related deaths in that year, and that number is up. What the press hardly ever mentions, though, is that only 29% of those were opioids alone. The rest involved people taking opioids plus alcohol, or people taking opioids, which are, we used to call narcotics, opioids plus benzodiazepines. So the opioids, the narcotics, get blamed for more than their share of the problem. And there's, you know, we have tended culturally to see the painkiller abuse problem as a law enforcement problem. So we've got a lot of energy and funding at the Drug Enforcement Administration and, you know, a whole institute, the National Institute on Drug Abuse, set up to look for harms of drugs, and practically no emphasis at all on what is the bigger problem, which is 100 million Americans living in chronic pain. So the numbers are vastly different. You have 100 million Americans in pain, and even if you only look at the 10 or 30% who have severe disabling pain, that's 10 million to 30 million. That's nowhere near the 12,000 people who die from opioid overdoses. So not to minimize those deaths, but the perspective is really important, that the context is the much bigger problem nationally is chronic pain itself.
And I want to get back to that, but, you know, as we do this interview, it's just days after Philip Seymour Hoffman died of a drug overdose. And while he had been a heroin addict in his 20s, he'd been clean for 23 years.
I know.
And I may be wrong about this, but I think I saw that he started taking prescription pain pills for medical reasons, and that led back to the heroin addiction. Is that right?
I don't know anything more than you know about his case per se. I've read about it too. It's a complicated thing. It depends on why he was, partly on why he was taking the prescription painkillers. There are people who have both pain, chronic pain that is needs to be treated, and an addiction problem. And those are people call them the dual diagnosis, people who have both pain and addiction. And obviously those patients are the toughest for doctors to treat because, I mean, in reality, just because you have had a problem with addiction does not mean that your pain should not also be treated aggressively, including with narcotics if that is necessary. So, you know, it's a nightmare to treat, basically, because you can have both pain and addiction, and both have to be treated. And there, frankly, aren't that many doctors in the country who are comfortable, who know enough about the opioids and how to use them in people who have chronic pain and a problem with addiction. And I'd sort of like to mention here, methadone in particular is very tricky to prescribe. You actually prescribe it in higher doses for pain than for, like, methadone maintenance for people who are recovering from heroin addiction. But it's a very tricky drug. It's cheap. very, very cheap, which means people like to use it. I mean, not patients, but doctors like to prescribe it because it is so cheap, and insurers like it because it's cheap. But it has the amount of time, just, you know, like 4 to 6 hours that it can combat pain is much shorter than the amount of time it stays in the body. So for people who are using methadone, they end up thinking it's in their system, but it isn't giving them any pain relief after a while. So they take more, and then they take more, and they end up dead in many cases. It's a huge cause of the overdose deaths is misprescribing and misuse of methadone. And that's another piece of the puzzle that hasn't made the headlines very well, but it really should.
Well, there seems to be, I mean, I've heard often that people who take pain medication because of pain can't get addicted. But after reading your book, I questioned that.
That's a great question. I think I can clarify that. Basically, if you're my doctor and I come to you with real legitimate pain and you prescribe opioids, if I take them for a couple of weeks, there is 100% chance that I will become dependent on them, physically dependent. That is a different thing from addiction. Physical dependence is a state of adaptation. My body has gotten used to having the receptors in my brain and central nervous system full of opioids. They love the stuff. They're happy when they have the opioids. If I stop taking them quickly, or you give me an antidote that wipes them off the receptors, I will go into an abrupt withdrawal, which can be totally miserable. I mean, that is not to be minimized. None of that is the same thing as genuine addiction. Addiction has a very particular definition, which involves craving, keeping on upping your doses, and taking excess amount of the drug, even knowing that it will do you harm, even committing crimes to get the drug. That's a different scenario from the dependence. As for whether people, you know, sort of good, honest pain patients taking opioids because they really need them for pain, getting addicted is what people really mean is that they will be dependent on them, and they will be. But most pain patients, do not get real addiction and don't keep upping their doses. If anything, the data shows that people, sort of the good, I hate to say good and bad, but the people who are really taking the drugs responsibly and legitimately, on average, tend to under-medicate themselves rather than over-medicating themselves. So they're actually sort of different populations involved. There are people with genuine pain who take the stuff responsibly, and then the people who are often younger who are taking them to get high. And they really are two very different scenarios.
Nonetheless, obviously, taking drugs for pain, it also has unpleasant side effects.
That's very true. That's very true.
You know, it's a complicated issue, and you offer a lot of hope in your book, Judy Foreman, in A Nation in Pain, of non-opioid ways of dealing with pain that have been pretty successful. And I'd actually like to start with one that is totally natural within the body, and that's the placebo effect.
Yes.
You have a very interesting chapter on that.
Yes. Placebos are good medicine. And, you know, basically, I would say to anyone, the bottom line is if something that you're doing helps, keep doing it. And whether it's the placebo effect or not doesn't really matter. I guess we should define the placebo effect. Placebo effect is basically that if you have an expectation that something will help, the chances are greater that it will help than if you didn't have that expectation. There's also a flip side of that, which is if you expect something to cause you harm or make you feel bad, you raise the chances that it will cause you harm or make you feel bad. The placebo effect is very, very powerful, and it's for things like massage and acupuncture and chiropractic. It's been very hard for scientists to tease apart, you know, what amount of the good effects are due to the placebo effect, you know, the person's expectation of benefit and what is the actual mechanistic thing that's going on in the body. That's been very interesting with acupuncture because there have been a number of studies where they give the person real acupuncture with real needles in the real acupuncture points, and then they give other people in the control group fake acupuncture. They call it sham acupuncture, you know, with fake needles or not in the real acupuncture points. And there have been a number of studies showing that both things help. So obviously, there's a big placebo effect in that. More recent studies show, using brain scans and other techniques, that real acupuncture, but not sham acupuncture, really does trigger a lot of endorphins. It seems to trigger natural marijuana-like chemicals that we have in the body, and it also seems to trigger this chemical called adenosine, which is a natural painkiller that's in the body. So I actually do think that real acupuncture is more effective than sham acupuncture, but again, it's been very tricky to tease apart the placebo effect.
And people were even helped by placebos when they knew it was a fake.
Yes. Yeah, that was research done here in Boston by Harvard researchers. Yes, even when they knew they were getting a fake, they felt better. So go figure.
We're talking with Judy Foreman about her book, A Nation in Pain, Healing Our Biggest Health Problem. Now, you mentioned marijuana, and of course, that's much in the news these days because there are, you know, more and more states are legalizing or planning to legalize medical marijuana, and two have legalized recreational marijuana. Why does marijuana work in some people for pain relief? Sometimes the only thing that works for pain relief.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because marijuana overall, if you had to put a number on it, is probably about 30% effective for pain relief, and that's in the range of opioids. So, you know, it's here we're kind of focused obsessively on the opioids when marijuana, which is way safer, there's no deaths at all attributed to marijuana. It is actually quite safe and more or less as effective as opioids for some people. I mean, you know, different things work for different people. The interesting thing is that we're all born with receptors, you know, these little kind of lock and key things in our nervous systems for marijuana-like substances. You know, we are born with this stuff as if, you know, nature planned it this way. Of course, nature doesn't plan, but it's set up that way. Our bodies naturally make what's called endocannabinoids, which are endogenous cannabis, essentially our own body-made marijuana, and we also naturally make the receptors that these marijuana-like substances fit into. And, you know, you have to speculate, you know, that evolution has come up with this as kind of a natural pain-killing mechanism. The way that marijuana may work in the body, there's some evidence that it seems to help people dissociate the emotional response to pain from the sensory response to pain. They know it still hurts. They know whatever their pain is as strong as it ever was, but they're kind of less emotionally distressed by it, less emotionally entangled with it. And like one woman who takes marijuana for trigeminal neuralgia, really horrific kind of facial pain, she says it feels like the pain stepped off her face by about a foot. She knows she still has pain, and she takes one or two puffs, you know, does not abuse it, and she can get through her day. She's in pain, but she's not as, you know, emotionally enmeshed with it.
Then the question is, getting through her day can be more difficult for other reasons. And that might, you know, there are some people who are really looking into, now that it's being legalized in a number of states, are looking into non-mind-altering marijuana that can just be used for pain. What are some of your thoughts on that? I mean, would that be as effective?
Possibly not. The synthetic marijuanas that are on the market tend to be aiming at that, trying to get the pain-killing effects of marijuana without the high. There's two basic ingredients in the natural marijuana plant. One is THC, which everybody knows, tetrahydrocannabinol, And the other is cannabidiol. And, you know, forget the name. It's just call it CBD. And in the natural plant, there's kind of a normal balance between these two substances. In the black market marijuana that people get on the street, the benign stuff, or benign is the wrong word, but the stuff that doesn't cause a high has basically been bred out of the plant so that people get only the THC, which gives them a high. The theory has been to pursue the non-high producing chemical as a treatment for pain and get rid of the THC, but there is some evidence that you may need the THC to really get the pain-reducing effect, that somehow that does act on the system that helps us, disentangle our minds from the pain. So it's a very, very interesting and lively area of research. Not so much in this country because the government controls supplies of legal marijuana, and scientists have just not been able to get their hands on it. But it's a lively area of research in Canada and a lot of other countries.
Wow, that is interesting.
Yeah.
We're talking with Judy Foreman, and we're talking about pain. Her book is A Nation in Pain, Healing Our Biggest Health Problem. Now, you point out that there are many other non-drug ways of dealing with pain. Among the most successful is cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT. Tell us what it is and how does it work?
Well, cognitive behavior therapy is essentially learning to kind of notice your thoughts, and when your thoughts are negative, like if you're saying, oh, God, I messed this up, I'm a loser, I'm never going to get anywhere, or things like this pain is never going to go away. In fact, that is a thing that many people in pain, including me, do. It's called catastrophizing. And it's hard not to do because when you're in terrible pain and nothing is working, you do feel like it's never going to go away. So it's a big trap for a lot of people, and women actually tend to do it more than men. But if you can spot those thoughts and say, oh, my God, I am thinking this is never going to get better, this is never going to go away, cognitive behavior therapy teaches you to say, oh, I just had the thought this is never going to go away. And it teaches you to ask a question, is that really true? Is it always at this level every single minute of the day? And sometimes what helps people is to keep a pain diary and how bad their pain is at different points of the day. And that kind of helps you think, oh, gee, my pain was a 10 when I woke up. After I took a walk, it was an 8. And if you look at your diary, you think, okay, it isn't at the max every single minute. So it's not true that it's always this bad. And then you can sort of try to figure out what things trigger making it worse and what things seem to help. And you can kind of begin to tease that apart. And, the other thing is sort of adapting your daily routine so that you can have more and longer periods with less pain. A woman who's in my book has terrible pain. Filing cabinets fell on her in her office, and she's had severe back pain for like 15 years now. And what she does is she can only be upright for like an hour, sitting or standing. And then she has to go and lie down. So she does. She goes and lies down for 20 minutes. Then she can do another hour standing or sitting, and then lie down again. I mean, it's not anybody's ideal way to live life, but it lets her cope. It lets her take trips. It lets her do a lot of things and get through the day without letting the pain get out of control. So there are a number of behavioral things like that that can really help.
Another one that you talk about that also involves some sense of distance is meditation. Tell us about that and also about the changes in the brain that meditation does that may be the reason it's so effective.
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked me about that because that is one of the best things that people can do. There's a lot of courses around the country called mindfulness-based stress reduction program. The idea was developed by a guy here in Boston, John Kabat-Zinn, who used to be a molecular biologist, and then he got into this whole meditation thing, has become really an expert in the whole thing. Meditation seems to do something like what marijuana does in the brain. It seems to help you separate out the emotional involvement with the pain from the sensory thing, and you get a little bit of distance on it. At a basic biological level, meditation seems to shift the focus of the brain from the right hemisphere, which tends to be more have more emotional processing, to the left, which is a little bit more analytical. And again, that helps you get a little less emotionally involved with the pain. There are some researchers at Massachusetts General Hospital here in Boston, and they have demonstrated that meditation increases the thickness of the cortex of the brain. That's the outer layer of the brain. And they also have shown that meditation can increase gray matter. That's the kind of tissue that gets depleted in chronic pain. So in a sense, in a very biological sense, it does make sense that meditation would help with pain. And again, you know, it's not a slam dunk. It's not going to take you from a 10 on the pain scale down to zero. But if meditation can knock it down to a 9++, and acupuncture can get it down to a 9, and massage can get it down to an 8.5, and the opioids, if you need them, can get it down to a 6, you can live your life. I mean, it's a full-time job, but you can live your life and get your life back if you do all of the above.
And let's not leave out exercise.
Oh, God, my favorite. Yes. How could I forget? That is my favorite chapter. And frankly, with my neck pain, which is where we started with this whole thing, I really think that is what got me better. I went to a hospital here in Boston, New England Baptist Hospital, and they put me through what everybody calls boot camp, which is very intense physical therapy. I mean, they make you do exercises that you would think would just be the absolute worst thing for your back or your neck. And you do it under intense supervision with physical therapists and doctors. And so you feel safe. And you build up the muscles around the part that's painful, and that helps in and of itself. But the exercise also seems to desensitize this revved up nervous and immune system. And, you know, we talked earlier in your program about how the nervous system revs up in response to pain. Exercise seems to desensitize it, kind of turn it back the other way. And it takes a while. I mean, it took a number of months for me and for other people, but it really works. And it's kind of, if you have a lot of pain, you think it would be the worst thing to do. And in fact, that fear of exercise has a name. It's called kinesiophobia. And it keeps a lot of people from exercising because they really are legitimately afraid that if they move, they're going to make their pain worse. The opposite is true, but it gets really hard to convince people to do that.
Well, you know, after we've talked about all these different non-drug ways of dealing with pain, I think I could say that there is a positive benefit to chronic pain, and that is if it gets you into doing exercise and meditation and cognitive behavioral therapy, you've learned some pretty important skills for the rest of your life, too.
I love that message. I wish I'd thought of it myself. Yeah, I mean, no one would really wish chronic pain on anybody. But you're right. These ways of coping can be wonderful whether you have chronic pain or not. And it is really important to do a lot of these non-drug things because they ultimately are the most effective thing you can do.
Well, your book is just terrific. If you want to know anything about pain and how to deal with it, read A Nation in Pain, Healing Our Biggest Health Problem. Judy Foreman, thanks so much for talking with us here. It's just been great.
Thank you. I enjoyed it too.
Judy Foreman. And next week, we'll be exploring the exercise cure with Dr. Jordan Metzl. Make sure to tune in. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.